Welcome to the NSCA Coaching Podcast, Season 9, Episode 22.
The most important thing you do is your workout logs. And I had a whole chapter on that. If you basically don't understand your workout logs and don't analyze them and look at them and then prepare your athletes to do what their next sequence workout's going to be, you really have to be an analytical, monitor and analytical forensic person on the athlete's workout logs.
This is the NSCA's Coaching Podcast, where we talk to strength and conditioning coaches about what you really need to know but probably didn't learn in school. There's strength and conditioning, and then there's everything else.
Welcome to the NSCA Coaching Podcast. I'm your host, Eric McMahon. Today, we're honored to be joined by Dr. William Kramer, a foundational figure in the NSCA, former editor-in-chief of the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, and one of the most cited researchers in our field. Dr. Kramer has shaped how we understand resistance training, periodization, and athlete development. Let's dive into his journey and the future of strength and conditioning. Dr. Kramer, thanks for coming on.
Hey, I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the NSCA podcast, and hopefully some of the listeners will get a few nuggets that will inspire them one way or another.
Absolutely. That's what we're here to do. And to begin, you were part of the NSCA from its earliest days. Can you share what the landscape looked like when you first got involved?
Well, first of all, I started, in strength and conditioning as a young athlete when information wasn't really available, basically from grade school on up through high school and even college, very similar to thousands of other individuals. But when you grow up in Wisconsin in a small town, there weren't the gyms, there weren't the people that knew about weight training. So a lot of what my good friend and I learned from was from the York Barbell magazines and Strength and Health. We learned from Joe Weider's, muscular development and the All-American Athlete, which came out in the 60s. And you used magazines. And then if you look for books, there really wasn't a lot. Even I got to college in the early 70s, and I realized that there wasn't a lot of information. You had Pat O'Shea, you had Dick Berger did research, some research, you had Ben Massey, you had a few people that were doing sorts of research like that. Jack Wilmore did a study way back in 74. Jerry Mayhew did one of the early studies in 74 on athletes and resistance training and included women. And so what I was really inspired at that time that, hey, there's really a need to understand resistance training. And so during my whole undergraduate career as an athlete, a football player for 4 years there at UW Lacrosse, started off as Lacrosse State University, my whole goal was to become a better athlete. So what I really relied upon was being inspired, as I was in grade school when I was early on, knowing that Jimmy Taylor lifted weights. And he was a Green Bay Packer, and I grew up in Wisconsin and been part a few years in Green Bay. And that was what inspired me to, hey, I want to get some weights. So dragged my dad down to Sears and we bought weights, and my uncle had showed me what a York barbell looks like, but this was just all we had. And it was just inspiring to understand the evolution of so many of the individual athletes like me. It was the same type of thing for a lot of young men, depending upon if you had the advantage of having some lifters and gyms in the area, in the bigger cities, etc. But the NSCA, my first exposure to the NSCA was really a visit down to Lincoln, Nebraska to meet with Boyd Epley in about 77. And he and Ken Contour were talking about the concept that we're going to develop this Strength Coaches Association. Well, that right away caught my ear. I said, wow, that's going to be cool. And I was typically doing, by 78, when the first conference came about, I was actually coaching summer camps, because to make extra money as a football coach, the salary, you were a small college football coach, camps were making a pretty, you could make about a 12th or 10th, you can make a couple months salary just coaching one camp for a week. So it was sort of interesting, but the landscape back then was pretty primordial on all levels. There wasn't a lot of understanding outside of, again, what we knew from York Barbell and from Joe Weider and that type of information on how to construct workouts, how to analyze workouts, what to do with them, etc. I always tell the joke that early on in college, my roommate and I found out that boxcar, on a train weighed about 90,000 pounds. So we got it in our idea that maybe we're going to lift 90,000 pounds of weight for a workout. Sets times reps times intensity. So anyway, the landscape at the time and talking to Boyd back then, was really trying to gather people who were doing that as a job. How many people are out there doing being a strength coach as a real job in the collegiate or professional areas? And I think what we know now is if you look at the original strength coaching handbook that was published in 1978, I got my little picture in there, and everybody had what they had for weights. And we had a universal weight machine, which was popular in the 60s. And it was really kind of primordial. The weight rooms were until Boyd really kind of set the stage with the first larger weight rooms. They were just little holes in the wall. I mean, the first high school weight room I had in Marshfield was in a men's locker room. I had to put a cover over so that we could actually bring women in to train. And it was just, very simplistic, a universal weight machine, one power rack and a platform. That was it for a whole school. But anyway, that kind of sets the stage for really the real primordial evolutionary start of a profession. And I can go on with a lot of the other history, but that's kind of where it all was for many individuals. I happened to get more interested to use weight training again with Jimmy Taylor's profiling as a way to become a better football player. And I did, we didn't have competitive lifting or powerlifting or weightlifting in the area, so you weren't really exposed to that type of sport or those type of things. During my kind of upbringing and even into college, it was just peripheral, little powerlifting, that's about it. So it's really an interesting primordial scenario. And for women, it was even worse. I don't think I ever saw a woman in a weight room during my whole evolution as a young athlete all through college. It was just not something that was taught to happen. And we just finished a big paper on the history and mechanisms of resistance training in women that just came out. And two of my former students, Dr. Nick Rademus and Dr. Marin Fergala, who was part of also, I think, the women's position stand, which will really be upgrading a lot of things as well. So I can go on and on, but that's kind of the beginning history, primordial, inspirational, and it was so exciting to think that Boyd was going to actually put people together that could talk the same language. And then my other comment was I had been a member of American Football Coaches Association. So I was used to coaches talking, and communicating and networking and all that stuff. But here was a chance because of my interest in the science of it at the time, was maybe we'd start to learn something about it beyond just sets and reps, and kind of started from there.
You mentioned York Barbell, Strength Magazine, the early days, but you went above and beyond. You published over 500 papers, 12 books, mentored countless students. Now, a lot of them are professors at major universities. What was it that really pushed you over the edge to dedicate your life to this field?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't know if anything pushed me over the edge. I think the bottom line was I was sometimes the good things happen from the worst things. When I was in high school, I had made a pretty good mark as a player, and even and even from that standpoint, I was no superstar. I know what those were, but when people had scholarships available, I got hurt my senior year in high school, and my rest of my senior year was just basically kind of brought down because of a knee injury that it they didn't have the surgical techniques they did back then, and then they didn't do any surgery. Now you got medial lateral collateral, instability and you have a knee that doesn't work, it's hard to do things. And I was at a game where I was supposed to be playing a defensive position that I had done really well. People were looking at for defensive aspects, and also played both ways with center. And what happened is the scholarships got pulled. So I ended up getting recruited by Roger Herring, who was a Hall of Fame small college coach, and he went on to great fame. And I was at the beginning of that with a number of players. Dr. Fleck was also on the team a couple years ahead of me, but I got recruited by Coach Herring, and then I had to work my way through school. So they said, you got a choice. You can either work in this new thing called the Human Performance Lab that they're setting up, or you can do maintenance. Well, I was really interested, and I was a pretty good student, by the way. And I said, well, I think I'll take this idea of working in the Human Performance Laboratory in the cardiac rehab program. So at 18, I started work study, doing lab works. I mean, I remember, the one gentleman that hired me, Dr. Phil Wilson, just passed away. My mentors are kind of passing on now. And what was interesting, the first thing I looked at, he said, here, figure out this instrument. It's a hemocytometer, how to measure hemoglobin. So I was sitting there going, wow, here I guess I read directions and try to figure this out as a young man. But there were a lot of challenges. We've had treadmills, environmental, and the whole thing. But everything was cardiovascular, obviously. And I tried to bring the strength aspect to it. And I was fortunate enough to have my long-term friend of over 50 years, Dr. Carl Marisch, who was a young man, just got his master's degree from Cal Fullerton, and basically was working as a research assistant. And we struck up a friendship in my junior year in college that has lasted now over 50 years. And we've worked together and we've but he asked me, and I wrote a paper in my junior year, and it said, about strength training and strength training. And it's amazing, as I said before, there wasn't a lot of references. And then the teachers didn't want you to put in references from muscular development or anything like that. So when you actually looked at actual papers, in 1973, there wasn't that much out there. Even some of the real classic papers weren't out. But anyway, I started to say, hey, we need to learn more. And I needed to learn more because we did a lot of crazy training back then. We didn't know about overreaching, overtraining. We did these crazy, like I told you, boxcar workouts. I mean, that's got to be not good. You can't do 90,000 pounds. And then we did the million pound month, 67,000 pounds a day, this type of thing. But I think what happens was is that that search for information was really what really stimulated me. And then I got into, after I graduated, I got into the junior high school coaching. And then I went back, graduate, got a master's degree out at University of Wyoming at the time, because Carl was going out there for a doctoral degree, and he got me an assistantship. And that's a whole other story. Kind of another sideline to that whole thing was, I interviewed, I wanted to go to at Penn State and Ohio State, and I kind of got put kind of on reserve roles, and I was a pretty good student, by the way. And the bottom line is the two places that ended up kind of putting me aside or putting me on a waiting list or pushed me back, actually I became full professors at. So there was a degree of ironic phenomenon there. But I think that search for knowledge, that understanding that even today, well, we don't know, but there's so much we don't know. I mean, it just gets more and more complex as you pick up the paper. But if you have the search and the creativity that you want to really understand things, and you really love discovery, and you realize you don't know it all, and you basically build on what we know and the principles, and you try to do what's best, ultimately. My experience as a coach, and then I carried over as a teacher. I wanted to make sure I trained the kids, did the best for the people that worked with me, so that they wouldn't suffer not getting to their optimum, potential of whatever that was, whether it be on the athletic field, court, or whether it be in the classroom, or whether it be in their career. So, over the years, what really inspired me was the. I've got to be as good as I can be to help the people around me, and especially the ones that I was in charge of and responsible for them. So that's really kind of what inspired me in this, and it came out of this search for more understanding and more understanding and more understanding. And then you realize it's kind of like what Vince Lombardi told Jerry Kramer, that there is no end. It's not a destination. It's really a journey of how you live your life and what really inspires you. So that's kind of the core principle, the core idea that kind of went along with it. And I'm still interested today to learn more, to do more. But then the key thing too is today you want to build it on solid principles. You don't want to discard the work that people have done for their whole careers just to make a name for yourself. And I think that's one of the things that we deal with today, is that you want to make sure that, hey, this really works. If you're going to evolve a principle, well, then evolve it and build it. Just like we've done that in many fields. Obviously, in physics, you build on theory of relativity. You don't throw it out the door unless you got a good example of where it may no longer exist and then why it doesn't exist. It may be subatomic particles, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the key thing is that we've got a lot of major principles, such as the size principle. We now know, for example, with regard to muscular function, it's dramatically changed. And in a new exercise physiology book I just finished with Dr. Flack and Dr. Shaines in the fourth edition, we found out that the muscle structure, for example, is no longer the little accordion thing we all learned about for years. It's now got bifurcating sarcomeres. It has a lot of extracellular matrix. Titin is now much more, it's not a non-contractile protein anymore. It's related to the spring-like roles that it plays with regard to eccentric muscle actions. So we build on what's before. We do that with our knowledge base and our understanding and our evidence-based practices. We don't just throw out something without understanding how it builds and interfaces with what we already know. So that's the exciting thing about discovery. It's not very few of us are going to have the discoveries in the field of exercise science, in the field of exercise physiology or biomechanics. We're going to be building on things that have come before with lower amounts of technology. And the reason we know a lot more about the muscle, for example, is that we have imaging capabilities we didn't have 25 years ago or 50 years ago. So as and you think about what people did have technologically and how brilliant their minds were to really extrapolate, what might be going on and being pretty close to what is right. But now a lot of stuff is validated now by the new technologies that we have. So there's kind of a good thing about technology and a bad thing about technology, especially in our field today. We can talk a little bit more,
Yeah.
because technology is just flooding the field of exercise and recovery and all the type of performance aspects that are going on.
Innovation is a huge term in the field these days. It's probably carried some different meaning at various points in your career. What's been the biggest innovation that you've experienced within strength and conditioning and sports science?
Well, I was part of interesting question because I was part of a when I was a doctoral fellow in 1983, the NSCA, myself and Dr. Garhammer and a few of other NSCA members gave talks at the White House Sports Medicine Conference, a very kind of an intimidating platform for a young doctoral student to be presenting at. I've been very fortunate at that time with the role I did have play at the with the NSCA, but I was always impressed that ultimately we had one of the types of machines that were computerized machines that were being presented, and then the next talk was by Dr. John Garhammer, and I still remember this to this day. He had a picture of his 440 pound Olympic set on a platform in his bedroom, if I remember it right. And he said, well, this is the Garhammer 440, because people were naming these new devices. So I think fundamentally, it's hard to People have tried to do that with just tremendous amounts of machines, this type of thing. But the barbell in strength training still is that core principle of what it as a tool. And then you have many different things. My other good friend, late friend, Coach Jerry Martin, who I worked with at UConn for over 13 years in very innovative ways, I miss his passing. We've lost a lot, many great people in our field. But what I used to say is to Jerry, and I said it to all the students over the years, as we developed our undergraduate and master's programs in strength conditioning, is that it's a toolbox, and your toolbox is what you work with when you put programs together, whether it be for the workouts, whether it be for recovery, whatever it is. You got a big giant toolbox, and now with technology, new things are coming out every day. There's just so many different aspects of recovery technologies. And then there's assessment technologies. The big innovation that I thought was out of biomechanics. I mean, I thought force plates were just unbelievable when I started to use them back when I was at Penn State in conjunction with the biomechanics laboratory with Dr. Richard Nelson there. And the bottom line was that, understanding the whole phenomenon of force plates became really a core capability that to me was a big innovation in strength training, because you could analyze things very differently, and you could also get a feel for a lot of different capabilities of the kinetic chain that you were dealing with and trying to improve. Then many innovations came out, surrounding the ability for GPS came out, although I don't think it was as much of an innovation. Because basically, sometimes you can only learn so much unless you track it with more advanced type of aspects relative to decelerations, etc. So now you have a whole host of tools out there, a variety of companies, variety of products that allow you to look at a workout in almost great detail. That we had a thing that developed by Robert Newton and his group in Australia, the plyometric power system, which we could, it's a computerized Smith machine back in the old days, and we could analyze all the things of what happened to the barbell and its velocity, its movement, things like now you got everything that can do that. You got all technologies, and that's led to people thinking about velocity, thinking about power. But for the most part, the innovation to me that was most striking was the use of force plates for assessments and also for recovery, looking at recovery and looking at profiles of athletes relative to their ability and the stretch shortening cycle, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, it's about it.
It's interesting to hear you say that. Force plates, GPS. I feel like today we're a lot more connected to the biomechanics elements of our field. We're going back to at least when I was in school, and some of the things I've heard you present in the past, our origins really were in physiology, but more specifically, maybe endocrinology in a lot of ways. And would you say that maybe we're getting away from some of those foundational principles of creating an anabolic environment within the body through consistent training as we get deeper into athlete tracking, GPS, day-to-day testing, some of the different areas we're looking at today?
Yeah, well, I think for the most part, it's always an integration. Everything is there and integrated. In the book Athlete Development that I wrote with Nick Rademus and Tom Newman, I mean, I wanted had a lot to say in that book. We have the athlete complex, and the athlete complex is made up of many different features to make them ready to compete at a given point in time. And what you find out is that you have two major areas. You have the mutable things you can change, and you have the non-mutable things. The old saying, it's important you picked your parents well. So that becomes one of the things that we talk about. So you can, it's more for your point. I think the tools in the mechanics and the biomechanics became much, much more advanced. I mean, when I started taking a biomechanics course, We used to have to take a 16 millimeter film of the bench press, put it up on a wall, do preliminary type of analysis on the wall for every frame, and then you had to put it, integrate it, and then we did, software company came out and it got a little bit easier. So as technology made things easier, it got answers quicker. So really force plates, were also not necessarily simple either because there was no software output. You had very primordial software outputs, just like the early isokinetic dynamometers. They were you put a little strip and you had to measure all the torques by hand. So as software became more effective, we started to be able to utilize other technologies. Right now, with regard to the endocrine aspects that I spent a lot of time understanding anabolic and catabolic, we know a lot about that. We can predict much better now because of all the kind of the origin type of work. There are aspects of it that basically we need to understand, but we're learning. We've learned a lot to be able to know that, hey, you cut your rest periods down to 1 minute versus 5 minutes, you're going to get a higher cortisol response. There's no doubt at all. Your epinephrine levels are going to be much higher when you're under greater stress. So, and your testosterone is going to go up in relationship to the activation of the motor units that you are involving in that particular workout. And that means load plays a big role. But yeah, I think it's still an all integration of the physiological systems, the biomechanical overlays that stimulate it. But if you look at the old idea that Sherrington, the one of the great neuro scientists historically said, it what is the role of the human body? It's to move things. So basically, movement is fundamental, and it's how we then have to work against resisted movements. Then you get into the recruitment size principle. We get into some of the neural aspects of aspects of how that occurs and how the brain interacts to be able to create the theoretical engrams and create the series of motor unit activations in the primary motor area to send down the line to properly, activate tissue. But in weight training, it comes down to the fact that we're really oftentimes not strong enough. And we now, I just did a talk yesterday that, we can have, you can be very twitchy, you can have all the potential, but if you don't have the strength levels, you have problems with your ability to land properly, your injury promote, your density of your tissues are less, and basically you're more prone to injury, and sometimes, catastrophic with ACL type of aspects as well. But I think, the bottom line is that we now have a lot of technologies to be able to visualize quicker and not invasively. We haven't quite achieved that with regard to the whole endocrine and some of the biomolecular aspects, unless you get a blood sample. And but there are a lot of things. Look at the big advances in care of diabetes, with insulin monitors and everything else. You can use your iPhone to get your glucose levels almost. So there's many different technologies that probably will come out that will give you more information about different areas of metabolism and endocrinology. But it's not as simple as the, well, I shouldn't say simple. It's not as available or quick as you get from a lot of the other non-invasive parameters. So, that's part of what research will do. Research will then frame the anabolic, catabolic aspects of workouts. It'll frame the aspects like Dr. Fry has done over his whole career with overreaching and overtraining, non-functional versus functional. And he did a great, presentation at last year's NSCA meeting. I was unable to be there, to my chagrin, because of an old football back injury. But bottom line was, yeah, it's biomechanics has become more capable in a lot of different levels, and now then there's and now and the what we've known before is also sits now dimensionally with that. So it's all dimensional type of integration to understand what's going on with that athlete. But I'll tell you one thing, for everybody, the most important thing you do is your workout logs. And I had a whole chapter on that. If you basically don't understand your workout logs and don't analyze them and look at them and then prepare your athletes to do what their next sequence workout's going to be, you really have to be an analytical, monitor and analytical forensic person on the athlete's workout logs. And I've been to places where they don't even keep a workout log. I say, well, what was the last 6 months of workouts? So if I have problems, even at Ohio State, and I was Coach Martin and I at UConn, you Coach Hootie, we used to have to do it all on paper back in the day and translate it. Today, it should all be on some type of software so you can get back to what's going on. And then with software, you can even analyze it much quicker. So probably the biggest innovation, if I could, as of now, are the ability of software capabilities to look at workout logs. That's the vital first tier of an athlete is what'd you do in your workouts and what did they do in practice, et cetera.
That's a huge point to make, and I felt the same way that digital programming and just systems that will keep track of your workouts as you're completing them, that is a way overlooked area within the technology space. We tend to focus more on testing and prescription, which is really interesting to us. I thought you made some really great points about invasive versus non-invasive testing, and maybe that comparison between the physiological versus the biomechanics that maybe just are more accessible today with the advances in recent technology. I think that's really, it's a good framing for coaches to think about that in of, okay, well, this is where we're at today, and we have these technologies available to us, so let's make the most of these, but not forget the past of all we learned. And who knows where the future holds in terms of next technologies that might make some of those other areas just as accessible. You also mentioned integrative processes. Integrative staffing is a huge thing today. I know you're doing a role within the athletic department at Ohio State. Tell us about that.
Well, I think the book I wrote again on athlete development was really one of the major things that I put in there was that it's all about an athlete development team. The days of the single person being able to do all the different skill sets that we did early on with regard to our field, meaning as a strength coach, I remember when I was a strength coach at a small college, at Carroll College at the time, I was in charge of, I had to figure out how to do athletic training because I finally found an athletic trainer at UW Milwaukee to come over and help. We didn't have any athletic trainers. And then I was at University of Connecticut the first time back in the late 80s, before I went to Penn State, and I was in charge of the athletic training program because the way where ATC was at that time was pretty primordial yet. You did your 1500 hours after you had to. It was just everything is progressively gets better, but primordial starts were really there. But at Ohio State, it's been great. Dr. Josh Hagen is the one of is our head of what's called the Human Performance Collaborative. And then we have the performance innovation team. And then there are different members that play different roles that bridge the athlete, the sport performance coaches, and the sports strength and conditioning. And then you also have the sports analytics. You also have people that do all other aspects, sports psychologists and sociologists. You have people that do the biomechanics. You have this integrated team to meet and try to get the best information to the athlete in a timely manner so that their performance and their recovery are optimized. And nobody is it's still not perfect. I mean, we're come just our whole area of sports science and sport performance and the whole aspect of analytics is just coming out of the cave, so to speak. And that's because you can have great analytics, but you don't really understand the sport, or you can have great conditioning, but you don't understand how to use the analytics. So it's this integration of learning as a team of professionals working with a given athlete with a given sport. And I think those type of things are trying to be done at many schools, not just Ohio State, but they're just trying to put it together. But the big thing is you have to have alignment, and this is something I preached at Ohio State. You have to have alignment up and down the ladder. I mean, that means everybody on that team, from the sport coaches to the athletic trainers, the strength coaches, performance guys, guys like me, the analytics and the sports performance guys that provide background and input. You have to have alignment of the whole thing. And if you don't have common principles, common culture, and alignment, then all you do is you get little, like it happens at many universities, you have little, groups across the department or across the university. You have it really becomes one of more independent operators. Now, do you get everybody on board? That's the educational piece. I think Meg Ritchie, in one of her talks a few years ago, hit it right on the head. The biggest thing we have to do right now is educate sport coaches, because many of our sport coaches don't have the background that really evolved in the present day strength and conditioning and sports performance people, sports science people. They came out of their sports. They may have had no classes in exercise science of any type. So sports, you have to educate coaches. And that's part of the alignment that is oftentimes difficult, because their careers are hanging on it and they got to put trust in another entity. And that's the whole thing with alignments and this type of thing. And that's what everybody who's working in this area, you're trying to get that alignment so that you can coordinate and do things. We had it during my years at Connecticut. We had that alignment across the board, and it worked pretty well. We did a lot of innovative stuff there. I think at Ohio State we have a very amazing big program, and there's a lot of alignment there. We're still working on coaching education. I taught a course at Ohio State for a number of years that a lot of the coaches took. So every coach, that including football coaches, that had to sit and listen to me for 3 hours, 4 hours a week for a whole semester, they got at least introduced to the whole construct of the things we talk about in what we're doing. But again, it's a constant battle, as it was when I was in the Army trying to teach the important aspects and to one group of officers, and then they change over, and now you got to teach over again. So it's a challenge. Education is a constant thing for the athletes who are new, for the students who are new, and it keeps reverberating. And hopefully, if you get enough people that are really knowledgeable about what's going on and what's needed, the field as a whole has risen slowly over the last 50 years that I've seen. So kind of goes from there.
So building on that, what is it that excites you most about where you see the field going today?
Well, I think what excites me most is the fact that we appreciate the fact that strength and conditioning and sport performance and the whole aspect of athlete development is no longer just a haphazard, random phenomenon. It's one that is based in science. It's one and based in practice and commitment. And it's really based in the fact that you have to really work with athletes, but you want to have the skill sets that give them the best opportunity for success. So the thing I'm excited about is that we're seeing that integration of all these different elements to the athlete complex, that it's not just strength training, but you can be strong, but if you don't have other aspects of your psychology, other aspects of your life behavior, sleep, nutrition, if you don't have all these things integrating together, you as an athlete, and in today's world in the United States, you as an athlete with being your own corporation, so to speak, you basically aren't going to optimize your athlete complex to be ready each time you have to go out and compete. So that's one of the things we realize. It's integration of many different factors, and they're all important in some way. So that's kind of what's exciting, is this integration of skill sets and professionals that are coming together with a common cause and trying to do the best they can for the young athletes, which I think from the high school on up. What Dr. Fagenbaum did a great job, as you probably met and talked to, with regard to development of young athletes too. It's a progression all the way to the end of your athlete career.
So lots of topics covered today. I know there's going to be some listeners who want to reach out to you and follow up. What's the best way for them to do that?
Well, I think you can always email me, on my email, which is, if you spell my last name right. And when I grew up in Green Bay, everybody was Jerry Kramer and Ron Kramer is Kramer. Well, I stuck an E in there, so I told my dad. I said, darn. But anyway, yeah, it's just Kramer.44, at osu.edu. You can email me. And I'll be happy to, get back to you as quickly as I can. The idea is that there's just a lot of different things today that we have questions about. And I know I'm fortunate with Coach Marotti and the group at Ohio State to be able to really contribute the information and the knowledge base to try and work with the kids we work with and give them the best opportunity for success. And again, we didn't even cover today all the recovery technologies that are coming out faster than you can shake a stick at. And maybe next time we'll have to talk about recovery technologies sometimes.
Perfect. We'll have to do this again for sure. Dr. Kramer, thank you for sharing your wisdom and everything you've done to elevate our profession for our listeners. We hope this was an inspiring episode about where the future of strength and conditioning is headed and some history as well. As always, stay tuned for more episodes of the NSCA Coaching Podcast. And thank you to Sorenex Exercise Equipment. We appreciate their support.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Ian Jeffries, the NSCA president. You've just listened to an episode of the NSCA Coaching Podcast. Hopefully, it's generated some interest in strength and conditioning and the NSCA. If it has, get involved. Go onto the NSCA website, see what opportunities are available, and I hope to see you at one of our events where you can be the next leadership generation of the NSCA.
This was the NSCA's Coaching Podcast. The National Strength and Conditioning Association was founded in 1978 by strength and conditioning coaches to share information, resources, and help advance the profession. Serving coaches for over 40 years, the NSCA is the trusted source for strength and conditioning professionals. Be sure to join us next time.